Bernard McCormick of Philadelphia Magazine tells the tale and begins, "On the day after Christmas, 1930, a young man named Julian English committed suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning in the garage of his home in a small Pennsylvania town. The name of the town was Gibbsville. There was no such person as Julian English. He was a literary invention of a young writer named John O'Hara. But there very certainly was such a town as Gibbsville, and O'Hara brought it to life. Throughout his long and astoundingly productive writing career, O'Hara used Pottsville and surrounding Schuylkill County as the framework for his fiction. He got going as a newspaperman in Pottsville when he was barely in his 20s, and although he didn't live there for more than 40 years, he returned often in his books. Much of his most compelling work, including his best novels, Appointment in Samara and 10 North Frederick, were set in Gibbsville. It's not unusual for writers to draw on their backgrounds for their fictional settings. Most of the great ones have: Hemingway's Michigan and Paris and Spain, Faulkner's Yuknepatawpha County, Mississippi, Steinbeck's Salinas Valley, California. But no American writer has focused in such detail over so long a career and in so many stories on a town as microcosmic as Pottsville. None has subjected the geography, sociology, and history of a place to such rigid and continuing scrutiny. Pottsville was not the only place O'Hara wrote about. Critics divide his work into categories: Pennsylvania and Hollywood Broadway. The latter work includes such novels as Butterfield 8 and The Big Laugh, but Pennsylvania, within a 30-mile radius of Pottsville, is what O'Hara knew best. O'Hara is famous for his accurate ear for dialogue as well, and over the years there were few aspects of Schuylkill County life that O'Hara did not put to use. At one time or another, most Pottsville institutions found themselves in O'Hara's stories. Most of the towns around Pottsville were mentioned in thin disguise. Schuylkill Haven became Swedish Haven. Minersville is Colliery-ville. Tamaqua is Taqua. Lykens, where O'Hara's grandparents lived, became Lyons. Often the names O'Hara chose for real places have a touch of the insider's joke. For instance, Red Lion, 15 miles west of Pottsville, appears as Richterville, a departure from O'Hara's custom of using names similar to the real ones. Richterville, however, is explained by the fact that the writer, Conrad Richter, comes from Red Lion. O'Hara does something similar with Cressona, a small town a few miles south of Pottsville. This one comes out as Fairgrounds. To residents of the area, the connection is obvious. The Schuylkill County Fairgrounds used to be located in Cressona. O'Hara's most famous site, Gibbsville, was a playful salute to Walcott Gibbs of the New Yorker magazine, with whom O'Hara was friendly at the time he coined the name in 1934. If O'Hara had let the similarity between his fiction and the real Schuylkill County drop at simple renaming, he might be a more loved figure than he came to be. But his faithfulness to detail carries down to streets, houses, hotels, courthouses, and even houses of ill repute. In the minds of some Pottsville old-timers, he also circled in on people. When Appointment in Samara was published, there were people in Pottsville who would like to have strung John O'Hara up from the flagpole at the Schuylkill Country Club. O'Hara had been gone from the county about 5 years. His friends knew that he had enjoyed a small literary success in New York, but with the publication of his first novel, he was recognized as a legitimate challenger to the literary greats of the era. Appointment in Samara is a superbly controlled, short novel about a seemingly prosperous young man named Julian English. The narrative covers only a few days at Christmas 1930 and culminates, as we heard, in Julian's suicide in his garage. This was before the suicide ending became a literary cliché. In Pottsville, the book was received with shock. Members of the town's upper crust weren't able to begin to make an assessment of its literary merit, so naked did it make them feel. O'Hara was undoubtedly writing about the burgers of Pottsville. It was obvious from the opening scene, in which a wife, lying in bed, hears the sounds of an automobile's chains clanking through the snow up Lantenango Street. Lantenango Street was clearly Mahantongo Street. For years, Pottsville's most prestigious address. Lantenango Country Club, where Julian starts his suicidal deterioration by satisfying a long-standing urge to throw a drink in the face of Harry Riley, was unmistakably the Schuylkill Country Club. The Gibbsville Club, scene of a violent fight the afternoon before Julian's death, had to be the exclusive Pottsville Club. In fact, just about every reference to a physical location in the book corresponds to a real place in and around Pottsville, a nightclub 2 miles outside Tacua, where Julian insults his wife and offends the gambler owner by taking a shot at the gambler's girl, bore resemblances to a club near the present junction of Route 309 and 54. Although it's 2 miles outside Tamaqua, the roads have been rebuilt and the spot is no longer in the prominent place where O'Hara described it. There were also references to incidents familiar to Pottsville people. In one scene, Julian tries to think of all the bad things people in the country club set had done and calls to mind a couple of dozen misdeeds, a number of which were easily identifiable to Pottsvillians. O'Hara wrote that no one ever guessed the prototype for his most memorable character, but there were several men in Pottsville who sensed uncomfortable similarities between Julian English and themselves. And one Pottsville man went to his grave half convinced that O'Hara had him in mind as the mold for the offensive Harry Riley. Of course, there are characters in any small town who would fit into the O'Hara cast, and the author once wrote with amusement that several readers from small towns he'd never been near had accused him of setting appointment in Samara in their communities. McCormick continues, there is in O'Hara's work only one character who is unmistakably based on a real person, the character who first appears as a minor figure in Appointment in Samara and continues to pop up in other novels and many short stories, and that's a writer named Jim Molloy. In temperament and history, Molloy bears an uncanny resemblance to a real writer named John O'Hara. The dates of Molloy's personal odyssey, his trips back and forth to Hollywood, all closely parallel O'Hara's. It is when O'Hara is writing about Molloy that his fictional terrain most closely parallels Pottsville. If Molloy mentions an out-of-the-way roadhouse where his gang used to go boozing during Prohibition, you can bet that such a place existed somewhere around Pottsville. It is through the character of Jim Molloy that O'Hara occasionally enjoys a chuckle over his relationship with Pottsville. In the short story, A Case History, a doctor is discussing his plan to write a book with a lawyer. At least you know what kind of book you don't want to write. What kind is that? Said Buzz Drummond. Like the piece of tripe Dr. Molloy's son wrote a few years ago, said McHenry. Oh, but that was a novel. Fiction, he made all that up. He certainly gave this town a black eye. That's what I don't understand, Arthur. If it was all made up, what were people so sore about? He gave the town a black eye, that's why. And not one damn thing he wrote about actually happened. That's what I said. But you as a lawyer and I as a physician, we know that things like them happened. Oh, as far as that goes, I know some things that if young Molloy ever heard about them. So do I, Arthur, said Dr. Drummond. But of course, that is not the whole of it, and that's according to Bernard McCormick. He writes, O'Hara came to think of himself as a social historian, aiming to get the first half of the 20th century, as he saw and lived it, down in print. And it is O'Hara's keen ability to capture the way of life, the textures, mores, the very feel of this region, and the larger implications for this time in American history. That's what led WVIA Radio to undertake a year-long examination of the life and work of award-winning American author John O'Hara. We didn't want to wait 10 years for his centennial celebration, so we went on to mark the 90th anniversary of O'Hara's birth in Pottsville with an expansive and varied series of programs and events beyond what we innocently imagined at the start. There were too many serendipitous happenings to mention, but first and foremost, the success and impact of the WVIA O'Hara effort can be attributed to its project director, Mary Beth Evans, a well-known arts journalist, dance authority, librarian in the area, and at the time a volunteer at WVIA Radio, assisting with our arts organizing and cataloging. In the project, each week we produced a radio program of some sort, interviews, readings of O'Hara's work, for instance. At the time, we had no translator to serve Pottsville, so we sent each show on reel-to-reel tape to a commercial station there so that O'Hara's hometown could take part fully in the exploration of its native son. Tomorrow, January 31st, 2025, will mark the 120th anniversary of O'Hara's birth. And we wanted to take the opportunity to celebrate the memory of John O'Hara. And as we continue to mark the 50th anniversary of WVIA Radio that began in 2023, we wanted to remember the efforts we made to see what was to be learned about that time in our region's history. Mary Beth Evans went on to settle in South Carolina, becoming the Community Services Coordinator at the Anderson County Library and Chair of the South Carolina Academy of Authors. We had a chance to catch up with Mary Beth, and we asked her to help us remember John O'Hara on the eve of his birthday.
John O'Hara was a child of the region. That's the area between Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and Scranton. That's the corridor that the anthracite trains traveled. And he was truly a person of the region, same as I am, same as many of our listeners are. And he was the son of a doctor, Dr. Patrick O'Hara, and his mother, Catherine Delaney. He had five siblings, and he grew up to be a very influential writer of his time. That's what he particularly wanted to be known for, of writing of his time and of his people. He wrote over 402 short stories that were published in collections. 247 of them were published in the New Yorker magazine. And that is a record that is still held today. No one has surpassed it. He wrote 14 novels, 3 novellas, essays. It's just incredible, everything that he wrote. Many of his books were turned into films, Butterfield 8 with Elizabeth Taylor, 10 North Frederick with Gary Cooper, From the Terrace with Joanne Woodward and Paul Newman. I mean, these were heavy hitters portraying his characters. He won a National Book Award. He wanted a Nobel Prize desperately, but never received one. He was a voice of his time. And whether that time has passed, you have to read his books. You have to read the short stories to see if truly they have. I don't think they have, but who knows?
Well, we felt at the time we wanted to examine his life and work that he still had something to say to us here, to help us understand who we were at that time and where we came from, those who were rooted in this region.
Yes, and it does that, and I think we proved it. When you read his works, it is in the voice of the people of the region. I know here I live in South Carolina now and have for over 20 years, but still when I'm feeling a little nostalgic for the area or a little homesick, I will pull out one of the collections and just start reading, and it takes me back. It brings me back home because of how he writes, the rhythm of the speech he has in his writing, the way we say words, the way we put words together, the way we hesitate when we're speaking. It's all there in his writing. And it's also there in his stories, whether they're the New York stories, whether they're California stories, L.A. stories. But the regional stories, the stories of the region, of Pottsville, which he called Gibbsville, there are voices. And I haven't been back there now for some time, but I imagine y'all still have that cadence.
And he was someone who could write a scene set in Gibbsville that we would recognize, right?
Yes. Oh, definitely. He could paint a picture with just the words. I mean, there's one of his novels, and I think it's 10 North Frederick, that opens with a very long paragraph. But in that long paragraph, he totally sets the scene for what's going to happen throughout the rest of the book and what's going to happen to the characters. It's amazing what he does in that one paragraph. And it is a long one. It goes over to the next page. But it is so evocative of where you are going to be and who you are going to meet and what you're going to experience. I always read it when I've done lifelong learning classes here in Anderson, South Carolina, at Anderson University. And I've always read that aloud to the class to demonstrate the power that he had in describing a scene. And it's very clear in his short story, The Doctor's Son. That's another great one to just read from, because it does paint the picture and it does introduce you to the people that are going to be in that story. And you identify with them, you feel for them, and you feel with them. And I think for me, it's almost inevitable that at the end of any short story I read, I have this feeling of, whoa, wow, yeah, he nailed it, yeah. It's very rare that I'm disappointed by anything that he wrote. I mean, yeah, every writer writes clunkers. But with O'Hara, there weren't a lot of clunkers. There really weren't, for me at least. He always nails it. That's what he wanted to be known for, to be an honest writer. And I think he did it. I really do think he did it.
He was concerned in his telling of stories of this place and elsewhere with class distinctions, wasn't he?
Definitely, yes, yes. And that is what's going to define the tensions within all his writing, whether it's of the region or of other places. There is always tension between his characters. His stories aren't really happy. There's not a lot of celebratory moments in his stories, but there's this honest tension that he had from the beginning. The Doctor's Son is about his life as the son of his father, and the tension between the two of them, where he wants to love his father, he does love his father, and he wants his father so much to love him, and his father does love him, but he wants to see it, he wants to know it, and he wants his father to recognize him for who he is. And that runs throughout all his work, that tension between people. And as you say, the rich. He loved being rich, and he did become very well off. Lived in Princeton, New Jersey at the end of his life. But he didn't always subscribe to how the rich might function or act. Frank McShane, one of his biographers, wrote in his book that although he liked upper-class life, he was too honest to accept its values in his writing. It was not easy for him to strike a balance between these opposed forces, but in his best work, there is a tension between the two aspects of his nature, between his social views and his artistic honesty, as well as the conflict between his ambition and his love for other human beings. A lot of people didn't like O'Hara, and he could be nasty, but he also had a great love for the people he did care about. And he cared about a lot of people. His sister, Kathleen O'Hara Foldner, whom we had involved with the project, commented to me on his support for his family, for his other brothers and sisters, particularly after his father passed away. It was up to John, as the oldest, to sort of take his father's place, which he couldn't do, and he knew he couldn't do it. And it was very frustrating to him, but Kathleen commented he was always there. He might not be there when you wanted him to be there, but he would be there. If you knew you had to get to him, he would come. Kathleen loved him dearly, was very impressed with him. He was her big brother, and she had nothing but admiration for him. She recognized his foibles, his weaknesses, but she always came back to how much he cared for his family, how much he cared for the people around him that really meant so much to him. His daughter, Wiley, his wives, Belle particularly, and Catherine afterwards. He was married 3 times. But she would comment on his great love for the people around him.
The idea that we were able to involve his family in this year-long examination of O'Hara and his life and work did add a lot to the mix, not just for us, but I think some new ground was broken in terms of the scholarship and what we know and what we understand about O'Hara. Isn't that true?
Oh, that is so true, Erica. That is so true. It was such an experience to have so many people knowing about O'Hara, living with O'Hara, admiring O'Hara, all in the same room with us when we did the conference, which closed the year. I mean, we had professors from all over the country, University of South Carolina, Pace University, Colby College in Maine, Susquehanna University, Penn State University. And yes, his daughter Wiley came. Wiley's a very private person, and it was such a joy to have her there. Her children were there, Teo and Nicholas. I don't remember if Belle was there, too. I think she was. And then Kathleen came with her sons, Robert and Tom, and it was just such an amazing coming together of that. And the things we learned from the academics, not just at the conference, but throughout the year, because we interviewed them on the shows, and they weren't just about O'Hara. They were about the region. We talked about the miners' villages that Dr. O'Hara knew very well in his practice and where John grew up. I mean, we just had this fantastic tapestry of information, of knowledge, that was just so incredible to have all in one place at one time. It really was. It was a year where all the stars aligned. It was amazing. It really was. I still get shivers when I think about it and what we did. And I don't think we knew we were doing it. That's the fun of it. And it isn't until you look back at it that you say, wow, we really made a difference. I think we really made a difference.
And Mary Beth, we can't not tell the story because it is a remarkable story. Speaking of scholars and those who have devoted at least part of their academic careers to getting to know everything they could about O'Hara and assessing it, the one thing that was frustrating for all of them seemed to be the fact that, yes, they had the films of Butterfield 8, 10 North Frederick, but everyone wanted to see Appointment in Samara made into a movie, and that means scholars, film lovers, fans of literature, and the general public as well. But that movie was never made. And if you just tell that story, it is quite astonishing.
It is quite a story. Appointment in Samara was O'Hara's first novel, written in 1934. And Robert Montgomery, fine actor back in his day, known to be the father of Elizabeth Montgomery, who played in Bewitched, the sitcom Bewitched. Robert Montgomery put it together as a live teleplay in 1953. He had a program, Robert Montgomery Presents, and they put this on live, Appointment in Samara, with Robert Montgomery playing Julian English, and Margaret Ryan, I believe, is Caroline. And that was it. One time. Done. Gone. In working on this project, Wiley, O'Hara Doughty, again, O'Hara's daughter, mentioned the kinescope. That was back in the day. I'm not terribly well-versed in that background, so I can't tell exactly how it worked.
You, of course, remember George Graham, Mary Beth, our engineer par excellence, and he explained to me that a kinescope was made from the TV screen. As the show was being broadcast, the film camera was aimed at the screen, and that's what was recorded.
Uh-huh. It certainly was harder to do, to preserve a recording of a live teleplay in this case. She knew, or she thought it existed, but she had no idea where it was. No one had seen it. No one knew anything about it. She just figured it had to be there, and she figured the one person who would know about it would be the director of the show, which was Herbert Byard Swope, Jr. And so we had to find that kinescope. We really felt we had to find that. And she only knew that, the last she knew, that he lived in Palm Beach, Florida. So you said, well, let's contact the public radio station down there in Palm Beach. And I followed through, contacted the public radio and television station in Palm Beach. And I explained to the person who answered the phone what I was looking for. She then took me over to another gentleman, and I explained to him what I was looking for, what we were doing. And he said, yeah, hold on a moment. Mike, a lady wants to know about Swope. And Mike comes on the phone. And it turns out that they had interviewed Herbert Byard Swope, Jr. just a few weeks ago, a month or so ago, for the radio station. And he gave me his phone number. And I am now, like, I've got these butterflies in my stomach thinking, wow, how close are we? And I call the phone number, and a housekeeper answers. And she says, just a moment. And in a moment, I am talking to Herbert Byard Swope, Jr. And I explain to him who I am, what we're doing, why I'm calling. And I ask him, might you know anything about the kinescope? And he said, I do. He said, I have it. And I went, really? Do you think we can get a copy of it? And it was just so incredible that there it was. And he said, certainly, if we can arrange for it getting copied, you can have it. I was so excited, just so excited, on the other end of the phone. I'm trying to be very professional, and I'm wanting to scream that we have found this kinescope. And what happened, of course, is you went down to Palm Beach. You interviewed him, came to know him as Ottie, and had this wonderful interview with him that we ran when we did broadcast the kinescope. You brought it back with us. The public radio, public television station down there in Palm Beach made the copies for us. You brought it back, put together the interview with Swope, and we aired it.
A program thought to have been lost, not seen in over 40 years. And thanks to your doggedness, Mary Beth, we were able to show it in public for the first time since it aired on Robert Montgomery Presents.
Truly. And Wiley was beside herself. I think she really was beside herself. She was very pleased. She's not a demonstrative person, but I think she was really pleased at what we accomplished there.
The odd thing was, Mary Beth, and how can we talk about coincidences? Before the evening of the screening, I was on the radio promoting the conference, and a fellow was driving on 81 who had no ties to our area but was listening to the public radio station in the region. He was the lighting director of this Robert Montgomery Presents appointment in Samara. And he sort of did a... And he showed up at the screening because he couldn't not. He remembered the production vividly, and he told us all about it.
Isn't that incredible? That's what I say. All the stars aligned for this project. It was meant to happen, and I'm so glad we did it. I'm just so glad you had that innocent question of, do you think we can do something without John O'Hara?
And I'm so glad you were with us, that you were in the mix here, because you were the right one to be the project director.
It was not easy. But we had so many other folks working with us on this. We put together actors from the Scranton area. Your mom was one of them, Joan Mitchell. We pulled in the Kutztown University Reader's Theater. All those academics from all those institutions, local actors in the Wilkes-Barre area, there were just so many people that helped to make it happen, including the crew there at the station, of course.
You mentioned the audio engineer Todd Hauslander and staffer and actor Ann Ferrugio.
It was really an experience.
Who'd have thought you would have had time to arrange a bus trip to New York
yes.
to see the concert version of Pal Joey?
Yeah, I know. And we didn't even know that was going to happen. But yes, Encores did it in New York with Peter Gallagher as Joey. We did. We pulled together the bus and we took it in, and I think everybody enjoyed themselves immensely.
Ordinarily, this wouldn't have happened, but we were able to get into the O'Hara home on Mahantongo Street, where the historical marker is.
We took Kathleen and her sons with us.
And again, Kathleen was John O'Hara's sister, and the sons were his grandchildren.
This was another very special event that we did. She had not been back to Pottsville since leaving it as a young woman. She went on to New York. She was an editor, but she had not been back in Pottsville, and her sons had never been there. And we did. We took her there. She walked into the home, and she recognized it. It was in a transition then. It had been a series of apartments. It had been a building of apartments, and someone had purchased it, and they were going to make it back into individual homes. And she walks in, and she recognizes it. She recognizes rooms where her family ate. And then we would walk down. We walked down Mahantongo Street, and we passed the newspaper. We went into the newspaper offices where John worked when he was a young man. And then we did take a group of folks, again on a bus, for a day in Pottsville. And we had lunch at the Schuylkill Country Club, where so much of the action of Appointment in Samara takes place. And we had a group of actors, again, reenact a scene from Appointment in Samara there, which was, I think, to me, very freaky. It was quite a day. Both those days were really something.
And we can't not mention Fran Lebowitz.
No. There again, an interesting story. I had asked Wiley who she might like to have as a keynote speaker for the conference. And she first mentioned John Updike. Now, Updike and O'Hara didn't care for each other. There was a real tension between them. And it would have been a coup had Updike agreed to speak about O'Hara at the conference. And I did get in touch with him. And he sent a very, very kind postcard back to me saying that, no, he would not be available. So I let Wiley know, and I said, is there somebody else? And she mentioned Fran Lebowitz. Fran Lebowitz, at the time, had written the book Metropolitan Life. She was and is a great observer of particularly New York City culture, but culture in America. She's irrepressible. She's invited to a lot of fancy parties simply because of who she is and what she says. But she loves John O'Hara. And I called, I got a phone number from her press agent, publishing house, and I called the number. And she answered. I mean, she has an unmistakable voice of a rasp, this raspy New York-type voice. And I asked her if she might be interested in doing this. I explained again what we were doing. And she was very excited, very pleased. And I said, do you want to talk with me about this as we go forward? Or do you want your secretary or your people to talk with me? And she said, I am my people. So that just followed through with a number of phone calls with Fran Lebowitz. And she did come to the conference. She was our keynote speaker. She was wonderful, didn't use notes at all. And it was a pure joy to have her there. And it turned out the fun thing was that her mother's college roommate was from Kingston. So she stayed with her mother's college roommate. Which, again, just says to me the stars were so aligned on this whole thing. She had a great time. I think she loved being there. And it was truly special for Wiley, too.
And again, this Friday, January 31st, marks the 120th anniversary of the birth of John O'Hara in Pottsville.
It's fitting. It's fitting for us to reminisce about this. And maybe, hopefully, with some listeners, they'll say, oh, well, okay, let me go check. If they're interested in the Gibbsville stories, particularly, they'll want to pick up the huge doorstopper of a book called Gibbsville, PA. And as I said, O'Hara wrote 402 short stories, approximately 50 of which are set in the region. And Matthew Broccoli, who is pretty much considered, he has passed now, but he was considered one of the foremost authorities on O'Hara and his writing. And Broccoli put together the book, Gibbsville, PA. If anybody's interested in the short stories, that is one to look for.
And that's really what we were hoping for when we did the O'Hara year, weren't we, Mary Beth, hoping that people who listened, who took part in some of the events or the conference or went into New York with us, somehow would be interested in picking up something that O'Hara wrote.
That's what I say. I think we really made a difference.
Mary Beth Evans, Project Director of the WVIA O'Hara Year. She went on to settle in South Carolina, becoming the Community Services Coordinator at the Anderson County Library and Chair of the South Carolina Academy of Authors. You just heard us say tomorrow, January 31st, 2025, marks the 120th anniversary of John O'Hara's birth in Pottsville. And we took this opportunity to mark that birthday by revisiting WVIA's O'Hara Project that took place in 1995 at the time of the 90th anniversary. So thank you, Mary Beth Evans, for reminiscing with us today. And thanks again to everyone who took part that year. For more information, there's a good article by Peter Tourette in the summer 2016 edition of Humanities. That's the Journal of the National Endowment for the Humanities, neh.gov/humanities, neh.gov/humanities. Oh, yes, we're hearing Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey live in New York, and oh, they also just happen to be natives of Schuylkill County.